Il-program li ser tisimaw huwa miġjublilkom bix-xewqa tajba ta' Farsons Foundation.
Welcome to University Matters on Campus FM 103.7. I'm Patricia Cavalleri, and in this series we shall be hearing from academics about their research and from students and other members of the campus community about the many activities which will be taking place during the coming year. I'm very pleased to have with me on the programme today for University Matters on Campus FM, Dr. William Zammit. Just a few words about my guest. He is a senior lecturer in the Department of Library, Information and Archive Sciences in the Faculty of Media and Knowledge Sciences. He graduated B.Ed. Hons in 1987. He taught or lectured at primary, secondary, junior college and university levels. In 1988, he was awarded the Diploma in Library and Information Studies by this university. In 1995, he graduated MA History with distinction. And in 2001, he obtained his PhD in the same subject. He is currently, as I said, a senior lecturer. And his major research projects have included the cataloguing of the archive of the Order of St. John for microfilming purposes. I'm sure we could do a whole programme on that.
Most definitely.
This project was carried out between 1993 and 1999 in conjunction with the Hill Monastic Manuscript Library of St. John's University, Minnesota, USA. Between 2003 and 2008, Dr. Zammit worked on the bibliographic description of the Albert Ganado cartographic collection, which was subsequently passed over to Heritage Malta. Currently, Dr. Zammit is working on the creation of a retrospective bibliography of all works printed in Malta between 1642 and 1800. Wow. For this purpose, he has carried out extensive research in Maltese and foreign, particularly Italian, libraries and archival collections. Since September 2013, Dr. Zammit has been appointed as President of the National Archives Council, which is a legally instituted body responsible for Maltese archival heritage. Welcome to the programme, Dr. Zammit.
Thank you for your invitation, Patricia.
You have been on this programme before to talk about your work, and I hope you'll come again some other time to talk about some of the things that we mentioned in your very brief bio. But today we shall be speaking mainly about your new book, written in tandem with Thomas Freller, Knights, Buccaneers and Sugarcane, The Caribbean Colonies of the Order of Malta. The average Maltese, even one interested in the Knights, would not immediately associate, I think, the order here in Malta with the Caribbean, much less imagine that they might have been so very involved there during the mid-17th century. It's a fascinating subject. I was absolutely enthralled when I read the book. What sparked off your interest in this venture?
Well, Patricia, as very often happens in research, you are researching a particular area. In fact, as you rightly said, my main thrust at this point is working on tracing material that was printed in Malta during the rule of the Order of St. John. While I was doing that, I mean, you come across so much material, which is the fun of research, really. I came across some new information, never published information, about precisely this short, but as you rightly put it, this extremely colorful episode in the Order's history. Particularly, I came across a number of contemporary maps, which perhaps we can mention at a later stage, which are fundamentally important. I mean, we didn't have this sort of material, and so I said, I mean, this material, I can't leave. This material has to come out it has to be worked and be published. As it happened, I was participating in this conference about the Order of St. John and its relation with the other islands with which it had some sort of connection, Rhodes, Malta, etc. And it came ideally in the sense that, look, many people are talking about the Order and Rhodes, the Order and Malta. But what about the Order and the Caribbean islands which it held? So I presented a paper precisely on this subject with some of the new material, and that was actually published. It's now out. By sheer coincidence, another academic, Dr. Thomas Freller, was also working on the same subject. We communicated and we decided to work together on this book, and actually the result is the concerted effort of Thomas Freller and myself with this work coming out. So, I mean, it is really a sort of an accident of research that one gets involved into certain areas, but I have to say it was a fascinating experience, it was a learning experience. I mean, you keep finding new material, both abroad and in Malta, which is in the book.
For me, it was an absolute revelation. Can we just place St. Kitts, St. Croix, St. Bartholomew in a geographical context? Okay, we're talking Caribbean. Where exactly do they lie?
Yes, they are the Virgin Islands, not far from Cuba. Actually, not so far from Cuba. For a long time, they were disputed between the French and the English. In fact, after the Orders episode, when they reverted back, and when the Orders part, actually, because the Order never had the whole of St. Kitts. St. Kitts was divided between the French and the Order of St. John. Now, the Order of St. John acquired it from the French in a sort of indirect way, and then it reverted back to the French. Shortly after, the English took possession of the whole island. I mean, so quite a colorful way that things developed from the perspective of colonial possession there.
Perhaps before arriving at the moment when the Order actually did take possession or part possession of St. Kitts. Perhaps it's worth going back a few years and building up a little bit to talk about what was going on in the Caribbean at that time, in the sense of what was the colonial milieu at that moment.
By the early 17th century, you start getting this sort of scramble for Caribbean colonies, particularly by the three great powers of the time, namely Spain, France, and Britain. But we are talking at quite an early phase, so there are these islands have not been taken yet, or have been just, for example, the Spaniards had gone to St. Kitts, but they did not have any sort of permanent settlement there. The French went there, the English went there, so you start getting this sort of race, highly intensive competition between these great powers at acquiring as much as possible of these Caribbean possessions. In the case of St. Kitts and Nevis, the French had their own presence there. By accident of history, a certain de Poincy was appointed as the governor of this French colony. Now, this is fundamentally important in the context, because de Poincy happened to be a knight of the Order of St. John. I mean, this was something that happened frequently. Members of the Order were given naval, military appointments or civil appointments by their own governments. De Poincy is a fascinating character. I mean, he was certainly a determined person, highly ambitious.
Very colorful.
Very colorful, extremely colorful. And he took up this appointment, and he went there as governor of these islands. So that is where the connection between these islands and the Order of St. John starts. But at this point, I mean, the islands belong
to
the
French.
Yes. They belong to the French. I mean, French merchant company who did commerce in those areas. At one point, de Poincy, out of his own interests, actually, starts trying to motivate the Order into getting into these islands, into reaching an agreement with the French company, merchant company, which wanted to sell off the islands for the Order to purchase the islands. Now, as we said, de Poincy had a lot of contacts, a lot of things going on. Certainly one of his motivations was his own position, safeguarding his own position. His way of government didn't exactly please very often this French merchant company. So by way of strengthening his position, sort of if the order was to take over these islands, his own position, as he saw it, would have been strengthened. He managed this. I mean, he managed a lot of things, including actually this. He was, you know, he was a politician, he was a diplomat, he was a general. I mean, one of the things that the Poincy did was to take over another island so that he created this sort of group of islands belonging, his sort of small empire, so to speak. So that's how things developed from the early 17th century down to the mid-17th century, when the order actually got interested and eventually purchased these islands for itself.
What we should say is also why these islands were of interest to the French originally, what riches they had. I mean, at that time, trading was going on already from Quebec to Brazil.
Sure.
There was a lot of trading going on, so it wasn't just a matter of getting your little empire together. There was obviously huge commercial interest.
Yes. We're talking at a time when the Europeans are still going to the New World, and they are discovering some fascinating raw resources, some fascinating plants and vegetables, which, of course, I mean, in Europe, they were totally unheard of. And that was definitely a prime motivation for European colonization of these areas. One of the interesting reports that came out during the research for this book, which is actually very early in the context of St. Kitts, it goes back to 1647, when you have a member of the order who was physically on the islands. I mean, the order hadn't taken the islands yet, but there were already some members of the order, probably invited by the Poincy, etc. And this knight writes a report on St. Kitts. And it is fascinating. It is so fascinating that, I mean, we decided to reproduce. I mean, there are a number of these reports that are reproduced as appendices in the end of the book. And this knight refers to the abundance of certain crops like the potato. He even provides a rough sketch of them. He even provided what is possibly one of the very earliest maps of St. Kitts. It is a very rough sketch, but we're talking about a person who was physically there. So you get a rough sketch of St. Kitts with the key areas being marked there, and he also describes in detail the crops, the potato crop, the sugar cane, and other crops like indigo, for example, like ginger, that were so exotic for the Europeans. So that was really a prime motivation for European involvement in these. There were, of course, manpower, I mean, a lot of slaves. You didn't have to get slaves from Europe over there. I mean, you had the people there, the people were enslaved there, so the manpower was cheaply available. So commercially, yes, you had a whole lot of potential.
Yes, there was a real reason for being there.
Oh, yes.
And he himself built up quite a little empire of his own there. I mean,
yes,
he was, as we said, this colourful character. He certainly knew how to spend money.
To live a good life.
Mm-hmm, very much so.
Oh, yes.
And in fact, in the book, there is this wonderful, wonderful drawing, which apparently is something that you've discovered, really, the drawing of his reggia, really, you could call it almost.
Yes,
In the mountains of the
St. Kitts. You're quite correct there, actually. Yes, I mean, that is, I mean, I was doing research and I came across these two maps, actually, of one of St. Kitts and one of St. Croix, of the other island, and also an extremely detailed plan of the residence of Governor de Poincy. Now, these plans were somehow sent to Malta. We don't know exactly how they finished in Malta. They finished in the possession of the Inquisitor of Malta, Inquisitor Casanata, who was a bibliophile himself. I mean, in Rome, there is still his library, Biblioteca Casanatense. And when the order started talking about selling away these islands, Inquisitor Casanata informed Rome about this issue. But he didn't just inform Rome, he also sent these plans. And that is how these plants have survived. Again, they are fantastic. They are contemporary. They are watercolor. And particularly interesting is actually the extremely detailed plan of the Poinsys. I wouldn't call it a chateau. I mean, he had his chateau right in the middle, but it was a whole complex. It was a fortified complex. I mean, in the plan, one can clearly see the Maltese style, the bastion sort of fortifications that surrounded this whole complex. So you had his Baroque structure right in the middle of this whole complex. You had a front garden, you had a back garden, but then you also had areas for the production of sugar, slaves' quarters, areas, storehouses, areas for maintenance, whatever. I mean, it is fantastic. It is extremely detailed. And again, I mean, very interesting. And that is the beauty of how research works. I was contacted actually by a French archaeologist who is working right now on St. Kitts, and sort of, I mean, he is doing the spade work, literally the spade work on St. Kitts, and he told me, look, I mean, this plan is fantastic. I mean, I can now, you know, make sense of what we are discovering thanks to this plan, which is so detailed and provides. So again, I mean, that is the love of research when you start combining, when you work with other people. I mean, this whole thing, and I mean, something
you're
worthwhile.
You're enriching somebody up. Else's work
definitely,
as well, which is very, very,
definitely.
Very satisfying. One of the things which I found so curious, really, in the book was looking at these names which come up, I mean, in the history of the pre-1651 acquisition period with Cardinal Richelieu, and he had an uncle who was also one of the Ordre, Amador de la Porte, who turns up again in the story a bit later on. And then you get to the time of the acquisition, and there's Grandmaster Lascaris, who is on the throne, in inverted commas, at that time. And one knows Lascaris a bit, obviously, from one's history books, and you think of him.
A rather unfortunate character.
Yes, he's gone a
not
bit.
Not totally deserved.
Not totally deserved. But suddenly you see him in a completely different light, because all this correspondence going on with St. Kitts to see whether it was going to be possible for the order to take over. Perhaps you can take us through that a little bit.
Yes, the thing is, Lascaris personally and the order in general eventually got enticed with the idea of acquiring these colonies, because the Poinsy, and it wasn't just the Poinsy, there was this motivation that, look, big money can be made out of these colonies. There is all this raw material. There are the sugar plantations. There are so much possibility of, and we have reports again. I mean, these are included in the appendix. So the order was convinced that it was the right thing to go for these possessions, and go it did. The Poinsy remained governor. The order was hardly in a position. I mean, the order did try at one point to have him replaced. The Poinsy wasn't the type of character that you could
get rid of easily.
Again, he won the day. And the order, like the French company before the order, had to work with the Poinsy. Eventually, the Poinsy passed away, and the order then said, look, okay, sort of now I can be more sort of in fuller control of the situation. They sent a new governor, a certain knight, Desales, who was considered as a saint. In fact, this knight Desales was a relative of the saint. I mean, he came from the same family, and this knight is described as actually a saintly, as such an integrated person. I mean, in contrast with the Poinsy. And things worked reasonably well for some time. What started to happen was that the order started getting pressure from France, Louis XIV. France wants the islands back. Again, France is coming increasingly in conflict with Britain, not just in Europe, but also colonial conflicts, and France is asking for the islands back. The order had a report drawn up as to the extent to which the islands were worth keeping or not. The report clearly stated that, look, with more investment with the right administration, these islands could prove extremely profitable to the order.
The question is, they'd already invested quite a lot of money in paying off the Poissy's debts.
Yes, I mean, they were starting to get rid of those debts, and it was the time when,
to
you know,
making
you
the profit.
Making some profits. At that point in time, in steps France, sort of, look, we would like to have the islands back. So, at the end of the day, notwithstanding the positive report, the order was pressurized by France to hand back the islands. The order actually sold back the islands. Getting the money back was easier said than done, and it took years and years for the order to get at least part of the payment that it had been promised for these islands. But again, on a political level, it's a case in point where the Order of St. John, you know, when it came to deal with these great powers, France and other powers, but with France there were a number of such incidents, not just this one, the order was in no position to say no. So, I mean, the order had to buckle under and accept what France wanted out of this whole thing.
This is something, again, that comes out of this book very much, maybe just because I haven't read about it a lot myself previously, but the geopolitics of that period, how at one moment you've got the French in a weaker position in relation to Britain, and then for some reason some alliance crops up, and then they find themselves in a stronger one. And the Knights, as you say, I mean, Malta was a small place, and they also had a large percentage of their knights were French, if I think I'm right in saying. So they always had that pressure from the French, didn't they?
Yes. The pressure was always there. As you rightly said, Patricia, the French knights constituted a very considerable bulk of the order itself. So besides the strength of France, besides the fact that France, I mean, provided much of the wealth of the order, France also provided much of the members of the order. So France was, you know, in an extremely strong position. And as I said, this happened again and again. It happened under Pinto with his idea of acquiring Corsica, for example. And then France stepped in and said, no, Corsica, I mean, I will take Corsica. Again, you very rightly refer to this geopolitical, you know, conflicts going on. It's interesting, and again, I mean, it's in the book. When the order had to accept to cede over the islands, to sell the islands again to France, you have this reaction from Spain. You had the Queen of Spain, who was all powerful in those days in Spain, and the Queen of Spain is so angry with the Order of St. John for the fact that the order had ceded these islands to France. So, I mean, by satisfying France, at least for a period of time, the order had problems with Spain. I mean, and it is so clear. I mean, you get this correspondence, the Queen of Spain is so angry, she doesn't want to have anything to do with the Order of St. John. So, yes, one must also keep in mind the English presence. So we are talking about a situation where the island of St. Kitts is only partly under the order's control, is only partly under French control. Mostly the French and the order controlled most of the shoreline. The internal part of the island was under English rule. For much of the time, they worked well. And again, it is interesting. You get these reports by the Poissy himself, saying, look, we have done everything possible to maintain a cordial relation. I mean, we are living on this same island, but things usually worked out. Towards the end of the order's possession of the islands, the order was also concerned, look, the English seem to become more interested in this island. I mean, if the English or the Dutch, the order also refers to the Dutch, really want to take over, there is no way that we can stop them. So if the French are interested in getting the islands, okay, we might make money out of them, but on the other hand, we are risking big. We are risking that one fine day, the English would simply sweep over and take over the entire island. And that was another reason which led to the order giving over. And in fact, that's what happened. I mean, within a short time after the French regained complete possession, there was war there, and the English eventually took the whole island.
At the end of the book, you go on to mention suggestions made to Pinto da Fonseca about possible acquisition of areas, perhaps if I remember rightly, Ethiopia, yeah. Because I remember some mention of the Coptic Christians, yes, being part of the excuse for trying to persuade him to go in there, and he was told that there was riches to be gained, etc., etc. But in actual fact, he declined, shall we say, because he gave an excuse, but he declined because I think probably he realized that he was going to bite off a lot more, yes, than he could really chew.
That is, again, another fascinating episode in the order's history. Again, this temptation, you know, to colonize, and you get complex reasons. I mean, okay, one talks about commercial reasons, one talks about political reasons, but one has to keep in mind that the order was a Catholic order. The order was all out to win over, so to speak, non-Catholics. And this sort of missionary, at least on a theoretical level, was always in the background. So, as you are saying, these people are, you know, they need spiritual support. We are, you know, we are the Catholic Order of St. John. So our presence there would strengthen them against the infidels, the Turks, the usual story. I mean, this particular episode, it's interesting. I mean, Thomas Freller worked a lot on this, actually. But again, at the end of the day, and very possibly from past experience, someone like Pinto would, you know, at the end, when it really comes to
the crunch,
to crunch, he would decide against it. As I said, there were a number of episodes like this. I mean, we mentioned the Corsica episode, and again, another thing in this context, you had under Pinto again, you had two episodes where slaves, mostly Maltese slaves, managed to revolt and bring over to Malta a huge warship belonging to the Turks. It happened twice under Pinto, 1749, 1760. In both cases, Pinto eventually had to buckle to French pressure. In the first case, he had to release the Basha, who was actually involved in an attempted revolt against the order, in an attempted assassination of the Grand Master, who was the brains behind it all, and he ended up released because of French pressure. In the second episode, 1760, you had this huge sultan, this huge warship. I mean, it's described as we've never seen anything like it in Maltese Harbor. Pinto, of course, is rubbing his hands. Wow, what have we acquired? He starts to actually refurbish the ship. The French step in and tell him, look, you can't keep the Maltese slaves. Okay, they have regained their freedom, but you have to return the ship to the Ottomans. And Pinto spent quite a lot of money, you know, refurbishing this ship, and then he had to return. So, I mean, this is the context. This is the reality. And this reality goes back to this Caribbean episode.
Excellent. Well, we've come to the end of our time. Dr. Williams Armide, thank you so much for coming to talk to us on University Matters today.
You've been listening to University Matters on Campus FM. Do join me again next week. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye. Il-programm li għadkom kemm smajtu kien miġju plilkom bix-xewqa tajba ta' Farsons Foundation.